All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is, what is it, August 31st. Okay, and we're going to finish up chapter 3 today, maybe move on to 6. But I just want to remind you that the lectures are online at dr-j-gober.com. So you can go there. I'm recording them, and I'm uploading them over the weekend. So you can find this one in Thursday's lecture, probably Friday or Saturday, at that particular website. All right, because nobody had any problems or objected to recording and putting them online. So that works just fine. So last time we were talking about protein synthesis, and it's a two-step process, right? That's, I think, one of the last questions that I asked you. Because when you look at this slide right here, how many arrows do you see? You see two, okay? So there's one arrow between DNA and RNA, and there's another arrow between RNA and protein. And proteins perform all kinds of functions in our cells, right? So they're very important building components, but they regulate metabolism. And so what determines what proteins are active and are built in our body is back in the DNA. So the DNA contains the blueprint on how to make our cells and our body, and also how it functions. So that's the repository of information. All right, so this is a two-step process, so we got to come up with two different names for these steps right here. Furthermore, these arrows, are they a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? It's a one-way arrow. All right, so this is a good place for you to start with knowing something about protein synthesis, that it basically is a one-way street. These two steps are a one-way street. For instance, the proteins maybe that you have in your diet can't go back all the way, that information in those proteins can't go back and influence your DNA, can never be incorporated into your chromosomes, right? So, for instance, tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner or something, you never have to worry about waking up in the morning with feathers and a beak, because it can't change really who you are, because that is determined by what? The genes that are found in DNA, that are coded within DNA. All right, so information always goes in this forward direction, and that's what we call the central dogma of biology. Now, you might learn that there are some exceptions to this rule. A dogma is just a statement that says you should never question it, right? And what do you know about science? Well, you should question everything, because it changes all the time, right? So certainly you might want to question this, but not for the first test. Okay, just think that it goes in this particular direction. All right, so let's name these two steps, and to help us name that, let's think of the building blocks. What are the building blocks of DNA? Yeah, they're not quite amino acids. I don't like amino acids necessarily. Amino acids are an important building block for a compound, but how about a nucleotide? What kind of nucleotide in particular? The deoxyribonucleotide, right. What is the building block of RNA? Ribonucleotide. Very similar kind of compound. Very, very similar. All right. But now, what's the building block of a protein? This is where I really like your answer. That's the amino acid. Okay. So we got nucleotide for DNA, nucleotide for RNA with a little modification between them, but basically the same building blocks. And then for protein, a totally different set of building blocks. Right? Radically different. Amino acids are radically different than nucleotides. And you should kind of be a little bit familiar with what their structure looks like, right? If you practice that flash quiz, you'll pick it up. All right, so two-step process. The first step, DNA, or the information in DNA being copied into information in RNA. We call that transcription. And I don't want you to get these processes mixed up, transcription versus the second step we call translation. So I think if you just know what transcription means, you won't get this mixed up on the test. Right? When you make a transcript of something, in modern everyday world, what are you doing? You're just making a photocopy of something, right? So for instance, if you want to apply to another college or for a job or something, and this employer wants to see what kind of classes you've taken, and maybe look at your grades, who do you call? Admissions, right? And you ask for a transcript, which is what? Basically a photocopy of all your grades and classes that you've taken. And what about the information that you hand your prospective employer? Is it exactly the same as the information that the admissions office has? Yeah, it should be exactly the same, right? It's just a strict photocopy of it. All right, so transcription is basically a copy, and that's because the building block of DNA and the building blocks of RNA are what? They're nucleotides. It's the same language. So basically, RNA is just a photocopy of the information that's in DNA, all right, because the building blocks are exactly the same. All right, so where does that step take place? The only place that's safe for DNA, right, to be active is inside the nucleus, behind the nuclear envelope. So this process always happens in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. All right, and so there are genes coded in DNA, and a gene is just a sequence of deoxyribonucleotides, right? That is, it's a chemical set of instructions for making a particular kind of protein. So if your cell wants to make a particular kind of protein, it's got to activate this particular gene to build it, right? And the first step, right, happens inside the nucleus that we call transcription. The second step we call translation, a little bit different kind of process compared to transcription, right? So now RNA can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, and the information in RNA can be converted into information that makes a protein. All right, so where does translation always take place? Never inside the nucleus, but in the cytoplasm. And furthermore, you should know what organelle does translation occur at. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny little organelle. It's not a membrane. It's called a ribosome, right? The ribosome. And you should be aware that there are two locations for ribosomes. There are free ribosomes in the cytosol, and then there are ribosomes attached to membranes that are called rough endoplasmic reticulum. That's what makes them rough-looking, all of those ribosomes. Okay? And those proteins made by those two different locations have two different fates, right? The proteins made by free ribosomes stay inside the cell, work within the cytoplasm. Those that are produced by rough ER are destined to be put into vesicles, and they're going to be contained within vesicles inside the cell or secreted outside the cell. So the fates are different. Okay, so this linear sequence of nucleotides in RNA, okay, and the particular kind is messenger RNA, determines the linear sequence of amino acid, which makes up this protein right here. All right, so what does translation really mean? Let's see why they named it that. What does translation mean, like in everyday language? Yeah, converting one language into another language, for instance. So what would be some good examples? English to French, Spanish to German, or Farsi to Hindi, or any kind of languages you might want to think of. Okay, but the important step is, what about the information in the languages, those two different languages? What about the information? Does it change?
No.
Only the language changes, but the information stays the same, right? So it's a high-fidelity copying process, and that's true with translation for inside the cell as well. And we say translation because what's the language of RNA? What's the building block of RNA?
Nucleotides,
right? Nucleotides. And what's the language of proteins? Amino acids, so two different languages, so we just call that translation. Well, what about the information? Doesn't change, right? It's invariant. It's the same information. Okay. So genes are just lengths of DNA, a sequence of nucleotides in DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA, and then that messenger RNA is carried out of the nucleus, okay, into the cytoplasm, and that determines how to build a particular kind of protein. All right, so that's what we call gene expression. And the next slide right here. All right, so if you look at a picture of a cell in interphase, you notice that a nucleus might contain one or more dark areas, right? We would call that a nucleolus. That's an active part of the nucleus. And what it's making is a special kind of RNA called a ribosomal RNA. Right, so that's a very active part of the nucleus, and that rRNA is used to actually make a ribosome. A ribosome needs two different kinds of rRNAs to be complete in order for translation to take place, and those are made in the nucleoli. All right, so here are a couple terms, genome and proteome. The genome just refers to all of the genes that are coded in all the chromosomes that you have inside your cells. Right? You might have 10 genes coding for 10 different proteins. If you're a very simple organism, right, that would be your genome. And those genes are used to make proteins, like 10 different proteins. And so all the proteins that can be made by your DNA is what we call the proteome. And we used to think that there was a one-to-one correspondence between the genome and the proteome. That just means that for every protein that your body can produce, there had to be a gene for it. We now know that's not exactly true. We now know that the proteome is actually bigger than the genome, and so we want to find out why that is. All right, so let's look a little bit at DNA to see how that is. All right, so here is a chromosome, typically like what we would see during mitosis. All right, these are two daughter chromatids right here. This DNA has been replicated. There are two copies of a chromosome that are attached right here at the centromere. And so this kind of chromatin, okay, and what the heck is chromatin? I should probably describe that to you. Chromatin has two parts to it. There is the DNA part and then a protein part, and they're wrapped together. Right, these proteins are what we call histones. If we put histones and wrap DNA around it, then we come up with something we call a nucleosome. Okay, so this chromatin right here is what we say is highly condensed. It's packaged on these histones, and then it's wrapped some more in coils, and then there's some super coils to package it up into this chromosome right here. And when it's packaged like that, it's in a very safe kind of configuration. Can't be damaged. And is that a good thing? Would you like to have your DNA damaged? No, because that's going to change the essential nature of those cells. It might turn them cancerous or it will cause death of those cells. So we don't want that DNA damaged. So these chromosomes, when they're condensed, the nuclear envelope can actually disappear and they can float around inside the cytoplasm. All right. But if they're condensed like this, then that DNA can't be used for transcription. So this is a dormant kind of DNA. It can't be used for anything. In order for it to be used, it has to be extended off of a chromosome, pulled off, and unpackaged from nucleosomes. So we have this kind of chromatin. We would call this extended chromatin. This is the useful kind, but these are very, very long, thin molecules. They're easily damaged. So the trade-off of having extended chromatin is that it's very useful, can be used to make proteins, but what's the downside? Can be damaged, can be lost, right? So the cell has to be very particular when DNA is extended. Okay, so here we see DNA. And when we look at this DNA molecule right here, you can see how many strands does it have? It's got two strands. It's a double-stranded molecule. And the rungs of this molecule are just what? Phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, and then the steps of this ladder right here are made from the various bases that can be used to make DNA. And I think we talked about what bases can make DNA. What are the four bases that are used to make GC and AT, right? GC and AT, and that's the base pairing rules as well. Okay, so there are a couple other kinds of chromatin. Euchromatin is the part of the chromosomes that can be active in transcription. They're lighter in color. Sometimes we can talk about this as being extended chromatin. Okay, they're not exactly the same kinds of thing, but almost exactly the same, right? When it's extended, it can be used to make RNA. There's another kind of chromatin called heterochromatin. This is highly condensed. And so it's not just a condensed part of the chromosome. It is also permanently inactivated, right? So various things can inactivate segments of your DNA. And you might even pass that on to your offspring, right? So there can be environmental factors that can convert euchromatin into heterochromatin, and that is actually inheritable, which is kind of interesting. So that just means that sometimes our behavior, right, which can convert euchromatin to heterochromatin, maybe being subjected to various kinds of drugs, for instance, could even be passed on to our offspring, which is kind of interesting, okay? All right, so here is chromatin. This is condensed, right? But remember, in order for it to be used in that first step of protein synthesis, so what's that first step called? Transcription, right? Going from DNA to RNA. Transcription is a photocopy. The exact same building blocks, nucleotide language. All right, so here it is condensed. In order for transcription to take place, this condensed chromatin has to be extended. And that's under control within the cell. So there is an enzyme that can activate the acetylation of condensed chromatin. And when it's acetylated, it starts to unwind. It becomes extended. And an acetyl group is just a two-carbon molecule. And when that joins to condensed chromatin, it just starts to unwind. You're familiar with a three-carbon molecule. What's the name of a three-carbon molecule that we looked at in the previous chapter? Glycerol, for instance, right? Well, chop one of those carbons off, and that becomes an acetyl group or an acetyl group. And that's what this enzyme will use to cause chromatin to become potentially activated. So now we have extended chromatin. It's still kind of packaged in some areas with histones, but now it is open. All right, what's the downside of having this big open area right here? Can be damaged, all right? So the cell doesn't play around. It only opens these segments up when it really wants to activate a gene in this sequence of the DNA because it needs that protein, all right? But just because it's extended, it still doesn't mean that that gene can be transcribed. There has to be other factors that bind to this promoter region that we call a transcription factor, all right, which will then allow transcription of this gene in this location right here. So there has to be other kinds of chemical compounds that bind to the DNA that allow for transcription to take place. And there also has to be an enzyme available. All right, so what does transcription produce? Does it produce more DNA? Does it produce a protein? Or does it produce RNA? Transcription. RNA, right. And RNA is a big, long polymer, just like DNA is a polymer. So the enzyme that's used to make RNA from this DNA is called a polymerase. It's just an enzyme that makes another polymer made out of RNA, so we call that a polymerase. And since it's making RNA, we would call that an RNA polymerase. Will bind to this region right here and make RNA. All right, and when the cell has enough of that protein made, then deacetylation takes place and the DNA starts to package itself back up into those histones and supercoils, and now it's protected. And of course, when it's protected like this, then the cell can't use that gene for making proteins. All right, so acetylation and deacetylation are ways to activate various kinds of genes. All right, so let's continue talking about transcription or RNA synthesis. So we used to think that one gene would code for one polypeptide chain. All right, and each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long, so that's a big, long molecule. All right, so for transcription, you need that RNA polymerase. It's got to bind to a start sequence in the DNA molecule. And in order for that to work, since DNA is a double-stranded molecule, it has to unzip so that the DNA polymerase can actually see the sequence of bases on the inside of the DNA double helix, right? And it's going to bind to a promoter region, and it needs transcription factors. When we get to the later parts of the class, we're going to see that maybe some hormones can act as transcription factors. So when a hormone is released by an endocrine gland, it can actually initiate protein synthesis in various cells. Okay, so here is RNA synthesis, kind of in a nutshell. Here we have a molecule, and we see some base pairing going on right here. We see AT and CG. That should give you a clue as to whether this is DNA or RNA. Because what are the base pairs in DNA? GC and AT, right? So DNA has a thymine. RNA will never have a thymine base. So this has got to be DNA. What's another way that you can tell that this is a DNA molecule? It's double-stranded. And of course, the other reason is because, well, it's labeled, right? Okay. But on the test, it might not be labeled, right? So if it's double-stranded, it's got to be DNA. All right, so this region right here is extended because of some kind of acetylation process. It's been acetylated, and the RNA polymerase has bound to this promoter region, and it's caused the unzipping of the DNA molecule. And it then is starting to base pair ribonucleotides to one strand of the DNA molecule. And the base pair rules that you can see right here are GC and AU, right? So the base pairing rules are a little bit different when RNA is made. All right, so here is the growing RNA chain right here. And what nucleotide do you see absent in this strand right here? So how do you know this is RNA? You don't see any thymine in there, right? You see uracil. So that's a nice dead giveaway that that is an RNA molecule that's being made. Okay, now the bonds between, let's look at the bonds right here in this double helix of the DNA molecule. We see G and C, and we see AT. There are bonds between these base pairs right here. And what is the nature of those bonds? What are your choices? What kind of chemical bonds are you aware of? Covalent? Ionic? Hydrogen. This is a molecule that's easy to zip together and unzip, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So what would you guess is the nature of this bond right here? Hydrogen bonds. They're hydrogen bonds, okay? Mostly hydrogen bonds, which is what kind of bond in terms of strength?
Weak.
That's the weakest. So this molecule is pretty stable because it's got, you know, thousands of hydrogen bonds, but each hydrogen bond is relatively weak, so it's easy to zip and unzip this DNA molecule. Right, and it's also then pretty easy to base pair down over here with ribonucleotides to make an RNA. All right, so maybe you should know, what is the name of the enzyme that can make RNA from DNA? It's called RNA polymerase, right? Because this RNA molecule is just a polymer of repeating subunits over and over and over again, namely ribonucleotides. Okay. So that process of making RNA from DNA is called transcription. There are basically three kinds of RNAs that are made. Oh, this is maybe even a homework problem, right? The classic ones that we learn about is messenger RNA. That contains the sequence of nucleotides on how to put amino acids together in just the right sequence to make the protein that you want. So it's basically the spelling of how to make a protein. This tRNA, all right, I don't like this description so much over here, but the transfer RNA wanders around the cytoplasm inside the cell, gets an amino acid, and it brings it to where the workbench is for making that protein. What's the organelle that's the workbench for making a protein? That's the ribosome, right? So the transfer RNA brings amino acids to a ribosome so that amino acid can be inserted into a protein that's being made at that particular ribosome. Right, and then of course the rRNA makes ribosomes. You need a couple different kinds of rRNA to make a ribosome. All right, but here is a kind of interesting thing, and this is more recent kind of knowledge. There's also something called pre-mRNA. So this is a precursor to the messenger RNA that the cell is actually going to use to spell out a protein. mRNA is the precursor to mRNA, and it's made inside the nucleus, of course, and then it's altered within the nucleus to make the proper kind of messenger RNA. All right? And so different kinds of messenger RNA can be made from this one pre-mRNA. So let's look and see how that can happen, and what does that mean in terms of the relationship of the genome to the proteome. All right, so the pre-mRNA is a much larger messenger RNA, right? So here we see a molecule that's double-stranded. That's got to be DNA, right? And then from that DNA, we see a big, long molecule of pre-messenger RNA, right? So then going from DNA to RNA, that's what we call transcription. Where does that take place? Always inside the nucleus, right? Because this extended chromatin you don't want out in the cytoplasm because it could get lost or damaged. All right, and if we look at this pre-messenger RNA, we see that it has different segments. There's light-colored segments and dark-colored segments right there. Okay, and so we call these things these light-colored segments. Now, it's not really light and dark in your cells, of course, just for the purposes of this slide right here. Some of this RNA can be used to make a protein, and other segments of it right there are not very useful. They're kind of nonsense bits of information interspersed between other segments that are very useful for the cell. These segments that can't be used to make a protein are called introns, and these segments in between the introns that can be used to make a protein are called exons. And this processing within the nucleus will clip out these introns, and then it may fuse together these endpoints of various exons to make a messenger RNA molecule. All right, so if we look at this pre-mRNA molecule, you see that, what, three exons have been fused together to make messenger RNA. But maybe the cell didn't need the protein made by this messenger RNA. Maybe it only needed the protein made by fusing this first exon with the second one over here. And then it tosses out this third exon. All right, so this pre-messenger RNA is made by one gene. All right, but how many different kinds of proteins can be made from this one gene? Well, it depends on how these different exons are spliced together, right? So there are many different kinds of proteins that can be made by this one gene right here, and that's the reason why the proteome is larger than the genome in sophisticated organisms like humans, okay? So the introns are thrown out and the exons are kept to make the final mRNA product. All right, so the human genome only has about 25,000 genes, but the number of proteins that can be made is greater than 100,000. And so we invoke alternative splicing of exons. Different exons can be put together from one gene to make different kinds of proteins. All right, so we call that alternative splicing. All right, so this allows one given gene to produce what? Several different kinds of messenger RNAs, which then will produce several different kinds of proteins within the cell. Okay, so that's the first step. The second step of protein synthesis, what did we call that? That's translation, right? So that messenger RNA then leaves the nucleus, goes out into the cytoplasm, and it's going to bump into a ribosome. And here we see a really long messenger RNA molecule, a string of RNA of nucleotides, and the sequence of those nucleotides in this messenger RNA will determine the sequence of amino acids in a protein. And then attached to that messenger RNA are all these ribosomes. And then they're actually very busy making a protein. Each ribosome can make one protein. So on this one messenger RNA, I see maybe as many as 20 ribosomes attached to it, making that same protein over and over and over again. And so when we see a structure like this, we call that a polysome. And this probably right here is just, these are just all free ribosomes. So here is at a very early stage, a very early stage of protein synthesis, right? And look at these protein chains over here. They're longer. So this is at a much later stage. So a ribosome actually moves down the messenger RNA, reading the code, right, making a protein as it moves. So these are almost completed proteins over here, and then these are very short. They're not fully completed yet. Well, that's a nice polysome. All right, so this slide right here is probably one of the most fascinating things about the class. So let's talk about this a little bit, okay? The way that a ribosome determines an amino acid, or the location of an amino acid inside a protein, is by using a triplet code of nucleotide bases. All right, so here we have, come on, cursor, here we have a DNA molecule, and the first three bases in the sense strand is thymine, adenine, and cytosine. This is a triplet in the gene for a particular protein, some kind of protein. All right, so if you transcribe this, what would base pair with thymine? If you're going to base pair to during transcription, that would be an adenine, right? And what would base pair with adenine right here? If it's DNA, it would base pair with thymine, but since we're making RNA, it can't be thymine, it's got to be uracil. And then what base pairs with cytosine? Guanine. And look what we have right here, right? So here you got AUG, which is the RNA base pairing for this part of the gene right here. And this RNA right here is the messenger RNA that's being built with these particular nucleotides. The triplets within messenger RNA are what we call a codon, because one of these triplets right here is an instruction for either starting to build a protein or stopping to build a protein it's already made, or incorporating a particular amino acid within the protein. So AUG is a typical start kind of signal that also codes for methionine, right? And if there is a UUU, then a transfer RNA is going to bring in a phenylalanine, right, so that it can bind in what? The second position, for instance. And then UCC will bring in a serine amino acid, and it will then bind to phenylalanine, and a protein will finally be made, right, with this sequence of amino acids. So every particular triplet corresponds to a different kind of amino acid, right? So this is what we call the genetic code, right? So here's the code of three nucleotide bases in RNA that's going to code for one kind of amino acid that's going to be used to make a protein. All right, now why is that so fascinating? Because when we look at all life forms on the planet, they use the same genetic code for translation, right? So going from DNA to RNA is transcription. Going from RNA to protein is translation. And all life forms use that same genetic code. There's maybe a few minor modifications in there, right? So that's pretty fascinating. There really is no deviation from this dictionary right here on how codons will code for a particular protein. And that can be used as evidence to explain what kind of theory. Yeah, evolution, right? So we all kind of started with the same building blocks, the same kind of biochemistry, and since it worked so well, it never had to be improved. All right, so here's some molecular evidence. Now, it's not clear proof of evolution, right? It's just evidence of evolution. All right, so let's take a look and see how this works. Here we have a nice DNA molecule. Again, you can tell because it's double-stranded. You see some thymines right here. All right, and it is unzipped by, let's just say an RNA polymerase. Okay, it can unzip, and then the sense strand is used to make a messenger RNA molecule. All right, so going from DNA to RNA, that's what we call transcription, right? So here's the initial DNA sequence, TAC, that corresponds to AUG. All right, and then when this messenger RNA, here's a messenger RNA, binds to a ribosome, it's got to leave the nucleus and bind to a ribosome, this sequence of AUG, that's the first triplet right there, we call that a codon. We find that in a messenger RNA, and then a transfer RNA is going to bring in a methionine, because on a transfer RNA, it has a sequence of three nucleotides that can base pair to AUG. What will base pair in the transfer RNA to AUG? It will fit perfectly. What binds to A? That's going to be, but in RNA there are no thymines. It's got to be that U. It's got to be uracil. So on the transfer RNA, there's going to be a UAC. And it will bind right here, and on the transfer RNA, it's got methionine. So methionine will be in the first position. Then the ribosome moves over a little bit, and it sees the next triplet code, GGC. Another transfer RNA will bind to that location that has the correct sequence. What would be the correct sequence on that, the next transfer RNA? It's going to be CCG. We'll bind right here, and it's going to bring in a glycine, and a nice peptide bond will form between methionine and glycine. And then the ribosome just moves down. This messenger RNA accepts the proper transfer RNAs that are carrying the proper amino acids. And so now you have, okay, this protein that's made by incorporating these amino acids in just these locations. Now, what kind of structure do we call this when we see a protein and we see the proper sequence of amino acids? Right here. What kind of structure is that? That's primary structure. That's just the spelling of the protein. And what does that determine? The primary structure of a protein, the sequence of amino acids determines its secondary structure, and that's a building block for tertiary structure, right? So that's the overall shape of the molecule, which then will determine its function inside the cell. So that's how a sequence of nucleotides and DNA can produce a protein that has a very specific function in the cell via what? Transcription and translation, right here. So here is a transfer RNA. I think in Blackboard I showed you a couple pretty good other interesting three-dimensional pictures of a transfer RNA. And way down on one end of the molecule is the sequence of three nucleotides that will bind with the messenger RNA. This is what we call the anticodon. And then on the other end of the transfer RNA is the site that will bind the proper amino acid. And then this guy will move to a ribosome to donate that amino acid to the growing protein. All right, so probably you should know, where is the anticodon located? What molecule? The transfer RNA. And where are the codons located? What kind of RNA molecule? That's a messenger RNA, right? And the rRNA doesn't contain codons or anticodons. So what good is it? What does rRNA make? The ribosome. And that's the workbench for making a protein. You got to have ribosomes to make proteins, right? So you need the messenger RNA that has a correct spelling for the protein in terms of amino acids. You need the transfer RNA that can bring amino acids to the workbench. And of course, you need the workbench or the rRNA in order for translation to take place. So here's a little bit more complicated picture that just shows all of that. Here is the ribosome with two subunits. There is a nice tunnel through this ribosome that the messenger RNA moves through, and the ribosome just kind of ratchets down the messenger RNA three nucleotides at a time, which we call a codon, which then allows the transfer RNA bringing in the proper amino acid, right, so that the protein can be made. And when the peptide bond is formed, then this transfer RNA is released and the ribosome moves down one more location like that. And it just reads one codon after the next, after the next, after the next. So you can look at these base pairs right here. And here's a nice tRNA that's bringing in what? The next amino acid that will bind according to base pair rules for RNA. And what are those base pair rules for RNA again? It is AU and GC. Yeah, AU and GC. Okay, now some proteins have a fate of being secreted from the cell. They're going to be extracellular, and those are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum. So here are some ribosomes attached to rough endoplasmic reticulum, and instead of being a polysome, okay, floating in the cytosol, these ribosomes, when they make the protein, look, it actually gets placed inside the cisternae of this rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then its fate is sealed, right, to be secreted from the cell. Okay, so that's an important secretory pathway. And if it's secreted from the cell, it might be modified before it's secreted. It might be conjugated with a carbohydrate, for instance. So what's the organelle that can modify a protein made by rough ER before it's secreted from the cell? That's a Golgi body, right? Okay, so that's part of the secretory process. Okay, DNA replication. That just means making more DNA. All right, so the process of going from DNA to RNA, what did we call that? DNA to RNA? That's transcription, okay? DNA to more DNA. We call that replication. We call that replication. You might want to call it duplication and things like that, but that term never caught on. We call that replication, okay? And just like when you were doing transcription, going from DNA to RNA, we need an RNA polymerase. Guess what we need to make more DNA? We need a polymerase, but in that case, you're right. It's a DNA polymerase, a little bit different kind of enzyme. All right, when cells undergo mitosis, or when they divide, right, DNA has to replicate itself because you have a parent cell splitting into two daughter cells. The number of chromosomes should be exactly the same from the beginning of mitosis to when mitosis has stopped, so the chromosomes have to be replicated so that both daughter cells get a copy. All right, so first there is a helicase that breaks the hydrogen bonds of the double strand, and it kind of unwinds the molecule so it doesn't kink up, right? And then a DNA polymerase binds to each strand, and then it starts to add bases by the DNA base pair rules, right, by just AT and GC. All right, so we call that semi-conservative replication. So let's look at this graphic right here to see what we mean by semi-conservative replication. So at the beginning, we just have one DNA strand, right? Here's just one DNA molecule. It's double-stranded, just one DNA molecule. And these hydrogen bonds are broken, and it's unwound with that helicase. And that allows a DNA polymerase to bind to one strand, and then the DNA polymerase will move from base pair to base pair, making sure that the correct base pair rules are followed. All right, so we started with just one DNA molecule that's double-stranded, and then we end up with two DNA molecules that are double-stranded, and this is a high-fidelity process. All right, so the two new chromosomes should be exactly the same in terms of nucleotide sequence as the as the parent DNA molecule. So how is that possible? Notice that that helicase never breaks the parent DNA strand. It keeps the strand intact. All right, so here is the original DNA strand. Here's another one over here. All right, so the original, both original DNA strands will act as a template for making what? A new DNA strand. And as long as this template isn't destroyed, then you can make many copies of that DNA over and over and over again. All right, and because you start out with two strands of old DNA, right, and then you end up with two different molecules of DNA, each with one old strand and one new strand, we call that semi-conservative. So you don't end up with one new molecule, complete new molecule of DNA, and one complete old molecule of DNA, right? Each molecule of this chromosome has one new strand and one old strand, because the old strand is being used as a template to make the new strand. So that's why we call that semi-conservative. All right, as opposed to fully conservative or no conservatism at all, because you can't break this old DNA strand right here. Because that, what would happen if you break this DNA strand? What would happen to the template? It would be broken. It would be destroyed, and then you couldn't make a new DNA molecule with the exact same nucleotide sequence. All right, so that's DNA replication. That has to happen during the cell cycle. All right, so there's a process that we went over a lot in anatomy, so I'm not going to belabor these stages very much. All right, but there's a process called mitosis that is a part of the cell cycle. So here is the whole cell cycle. Most of the cell's lifespan is in a phase that we call interphase right here. And interphase can be broken down. Basically, the way you should think of interphase is that it's a growth phase, but it's also a phase in which the cell undergoes its normal physiologic functions. But it's also a very important growth phase. All right, and then when the cell is ready to divide, it goes into mitosis, right? And the steps for mitosis are, what, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. And telo means the end of something. Like the telomere is the end of a chromosome, telophase is the end of mitosis. And there's a word right here that means the middle of mitosis. And that is meta. Meta means middle. Okay. And so the purpose for mitosis, I do want to talk a little bit about, in case maybe you forgot about, why is there such a thing as mitosis? Why is there such a thing? So remember, mitosis does what? You go from one parent cell. In humans, we have 46 chromosomes, and then it splits. All right. Into two other cells right here. How many chromosomes are in this cell right here? You know what? 46. And what about over here? You could say zero, but 46 as well. All right, so from going from what we call the parent cell to these daughter cells, all right, to these daughter cells right here, if you have 46 chromosomes here and 46 here, and only 46 over here, what has to happen in the process of these arrows right here? These have to be duplicated. What do we call that when we duplicate a chromosome? We don't call it duplication. We call that replication, right? Those chromosomes are replicated. Replication is when you go from one chromosome to, right, a daughter chromatid attached at a centromere. So now you have twice the amount of DNA so that during mitosis, these two can be separated into the two daughter cells. So what's the difference between these daughter cells right here? Absolutely nothing. What's the difference between this daughter cell and this parent cell? Absolutely nothing. That's the purpose of mitosis, is just to produce identical cells. So it's a form of reproduction. All right, so mitosis and reproduction are kind of synonyms. They're kind of the same word. So I don't want to use reproduction as a definition or a reason for mitosis. But what's the reason for this to happen? Okay, you could say reproduction, but that's not a really good answer, because why? Mitosis really is reproduction. There's some other reasons for that. Why might you want to have the cell reproduce itself? I like that one, to replace old and damaged cells, because let's just say these are red blood cells. They only live for 120 days, and then they die. And then if they're not replaced, what do you have? What's that condition called? That's anemia, right? And so you lose about 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second in your body because they just don't live very long. So your body has to make 2 to 3 million otherwise every second, or else you'll become anemic, right? So that's a process of mitosis that's replacing old or damaged cells. Right? So that happens all the time. That's just one tissue that you have in your body. Okay, but that happens in all kinds of things.
And it keeps duplicating, like the brain is
two. Yeah, they could go another two. So that's got to be controlled. Otherwise, you know, if that happened uncontrollably, then you would take over the whole universe, right? But you only get to be so big. So that's a clue for the second reason for mitosis. At one point in time, right, well, there was a cell like this from your dad and a cell like that from your mom. They came together to form this cell right here. What do we call these arrows? Everybody knows. What do we call these arrows producing this cell right here? Here's a sperm, here's an egg. That's fertilization. Okay. Some of you might know the name of this one cell that we all were at one point in time. That's a zygote, right? We were all a zygote at one time. This is some biology, not really physiology necessarily. We were all just a single cell at one time, and that's not a very interesting stage of life because why? Well, you can never come to physiology class and take notes if you're just a single cell, right? So what do you have to do? You got to change yourself from a single cell to trillions of cells. And what's the name of the process that does that? That's mitosis, right? All right, so growth, all right? To get big is another reason for mitosis. So to replace old and damaged cells or growth are the two real important reasons for mitosis, okay? Or for this kind of reproduction. All right, so here we see replicated chromosome. These are what we call daughter chromatids right here. This is an exact copy of each other through semi-conservative replication. It's an exact copy. And it's packaged really nice and tight. It's protected, right? So this is condensed chromatin. And then through the process of mitosis, all right, those two daughter chromatids are separated, pulled apart into two daughter cells. And then as these are separating, then we would call these daughter chromosomes. So you end up with two identical cells. And if you want some more discussion about mitosis, I have some really good links in Blackboard where you can watch this, or maybe come see me during office hours or something. But we went over these processes quite a lot in anatomy. All right, so you can tell the beginning of mitosis because you see condensed chromatin into chromosomes. And then when all the chromosomes line up on the equator of the cell, that is metaphase. And then when the daughter chromatids start to separate, that's what we call anaphase. And when after they've been separated, then we call those daughter chromosomes. As the daughter chromosomes get pulled to either end of the cell, right, and the cell starts to pinch apart, we call that telophase. That's the last phase. And then the cell pinches apart, separating the cytoplasm into two daughter cells. That's what we call cytokinesis. Right? So cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. And mitosis is the separation of DNA into two daughter cells. And cytokinesis for this class, you should think of, happens during telophase. Okay. And the importance of some of these different organelles for mitosis. Right, the telomeres are just the ends of these chromosomes right here. Where's that chromosome at? It's just the end of a chromosome. And every time a cell undergoes mitosis, part of the telomere is lost. All right, and when that telomeric region is completely lost, then that cell is programmed to die. We call that apoptosis. So a particular cell can't keep growing forever and ever and ever and ever. But there's some cells that can grow uncontrollably forever and ever and ever, and those are cancer cells. All right, and cancer cells have a special enzyme that can replace these telomeric regions so that the cell never goes into apoptosis. So it keeps living and reproducing, and eventually what? It takes over your body, unfortunately, if that's a cancer. All right, so that's the importance of telomerase and these telomeric regions within a chromosome. Okay. Meiosis is a little bit different process. There's some activities in Blackboard where you can look at some of the specific processes. All right? But if we contrast mitosis and meiosis pretty quickly, meiosis produces what? Two identical daughter cells with the exact same number of chromosomes. Meiosis, on the other hand, produces four daughter cells with half the number of chromosomes. Well, maybe I'll erase this right here. So meiosis is a little bit different kind of process. And I'll just show you how to think about that. All right, so in mitosis, there's just one round of splitting chromosomes, but in meiosis, there are two rounds. All right, so in meiosis, you have a parent cell. Sometimes we might want to call this a germ cell. Some people call it a stem cell. That's maybe not really quite correct. That has 46 chromosomes that are replicated. All right, and it first splits into two cells that have 46 chromosomes, and then these each split into two cells that have 23 chromosomes. Each of these have 23, and all four of these cells are non-identical. These are all different from each other when meiosis takes place. All right, and these things right here are what we call gametes. These are produced in ovaries or testes. And what are some examples of gametes? You can't produce it like exactly like this. Some are going to be sperm, and some will be eggs. Right, either one or the other, not both by the same individual, of course, right? Okay. And that makes perfect sense because with the process of fertilization, right, these two cells will come together, and then how many chromosomes do you end up with again? 46, which is, you know, what a human being is. That's how it should happen. So I think that's all I'm going to say about meiosis. It produces four non-identical cells. Mitosis produces what? Two identical kinds of cells. All right, so look at some of the activities in Blackboard. Okay, so we're done with chapter 3. Okay, next chapter is 6. It's not much shorter. In chapter 3. And in chapter 3, we're going to use some chemistry principles as well. Oh, maybe I just started it and then it went over. Oh, good. Good, good, good. All right, so if you feel a little hazy on mitosis and meiosis, then you're going to have to read your books and look at the materials that are online. All right, so chapter 6, we're going to look at interactions between cells, how they communicate with each other, and also with the extracellular environment. And we're going to first start by talking about the extracellular environment, that is, all the fluid that's outside cells. All right, so that includes all the constituents of the body outside cells is the extracellular environment. All right, the intracellular compartment makes up about 67% of your total body water, so most of the water inside your body is inside your cells, right, and about 33% you find outside your cells. And there are a couple of important compartments for that extracellular water. 80% is just found in the matrix of connective tissues outside of cells. So we call that interstitial fluid. And it's held there by a material that's like a sponge. It's a proteoglycan. It's part protein, part sugar molecule. And its job is just to basically absorb and hold water. All right, 80% is in the extracellular fluid. 80% of the extracellular fluid is what we call interstitial fluid, fluid between cells in the matrix. Then the remainder, 20%, is found as the matrix in blood connective tissue. And what's the matrix in blood connective tissue called? That's just plasma, right? So 20% of extracellular fluid is plasma, 80% is interstitial fluid between cells. All right, so here we have a blood vessel with plasma. Here is the matrix of a connective tissue that holds about 80% of the fluid. And these are constantly in exchange with each other, bringing in nutrients, transporting waste products, okay, to the kidneys, for instance. All right, so how can material move through a plasma membrane? So remember, that's the first organelle that we looked at, the plasma membrane. And we think of a plasma membrane, what's the simplest way to think about it? Okay, phospholipid bilayer, right? So just two layers of phospholipids. But there's a better, more sophisticated way to think of a plasma membrane. And what model is that in your mind? The fluid mosaic model. So it's not just the phospholipid bilayer, which is very fluid, very delicate, but other things can be added to that bilayer to give it particular functions, maybe to help stabilize it, make it a little bit more rigid. All right, so the plasma membrane is what we call selectively permeable. It only allows certain kinds of molecules to pass through it. And since the inner part of that membrane is hydrophobic or lipid, guess what kind of molecules can get through that region right there? What kind of molecules can dissolve into the lipid region of a membrane? Only hydrophobic molecules or lipid molecules. So only hydrophobic molecules can freely move across a cell membrane, because that's the major part of the cell membrane. So many important molecules have transporters or channels, right? If it's a hydrophilic molecule, it can't get through the cell membrane, so there's got to be other ways to do that. So the cell will put a transporter in the membrane to accomplish that. So some kinds of transport are what we call carrier-mediated transport. That involves a specific protein that's used as a transporter. All right, but other kinds of molecules can just move across the membrane by diffusion through channels. Right? But a channel, don't forget, is still a protein molecule that puts a little hole in the membrane so that molecules can pass through it. So that's one way of classifying transport. Another way of classifying transport is by the energy requirements. Some transport will just happen because there's a concentration gradient. It won't require any other kind of energy, and that's passive transport. That's when a molecule moves right down a concentration gradient. Doesn't require energy. Other molecules can actually move up a concentration gradient, right? But it's going to require energy for that to happen, and we call that active transport, right? And so what energy molecule would be used in this particular case, if it's active transport, in most circumstances? ATP, for instance, right? All right, so I don't know if it's really hard for you to visualize, right? But one way that I kind of think about active versus passive is when I was in college, I think about the car I had, okay, which was like a 1965 MGB. Right, the car was about this big, and sometimes, and it was really old, so sometimes the starter motor was out. Sometimes the battery was dead. Sometimes I couldn't get the clutch to work. So it was kind of a mess. So when I parked the car, guess where I would always park the car, because I didn't know if I could start it with a key. Okay? All right, so here I got this hill, right? So here I got a hill. All right, so here's me in my car. So I would park on top of a hill, just like that. And if I couldn't get the car started, it was really easy to get it started, but I could sit in the driver's seat. It was so small, I could just put my left leg out the door and give it a little kick like that, and what could happen? The car is going to roll, right? From what? High to low. Down to low over here. And did that require any energy to roll down this hill? No, because it has energy just by the height being on this hill. And as it would get going, right, I would have it in gear, I'd pop the clutch, and I could go home. It was a great thing. All right, so going from high to low, is that a passive process or active process? That's passive. That just happens automatically, right? Passive. But if I was down here at the bottom of the hill, going back up, we call that what? That's an active process requiring energy of some kind, and that would be gasoline in the car. In your cells, that energy from taking a solute molecule from low to high, going against the concentration gradient, of course, that would be ATP. Okay, so think of it like that. So passive is always going what? From high concentration to low. Active transport is going from low to high. And sometimes we call going from low concentration to high, sometimes we call that a pump, right? Like a well, taking water from deep down in the ground to up to the surface, going from low to high, that's called a pump when we move molecules in that direction. All right, so this is a good way of thinking about transport processes. All right, but I do want you to know something about a solution. I don't know if you've taken a chemistry class or not, so you got to know something about a solution. All right, it's got two components in order for something to be a solution. It's got to have a solvent molecule, which is most of what a solution is made out of, plus a solute. That's just the stuff, the junk that dissolves into the solvent. All right, so what have you used as a solvent today? Water, okay. And what did you dissolve in that water to make it a solution? Sugar, yeah. Or maybe coffee or tea or something like that, right? The majority of that solution was the water molecule, but you added other kinds of molecules to it to make it a solution. All right, what's the major solvent in your body?
Water.
We're a water system. So things have to dissolve in water. What kind of compounds can dissolve in water? Polar compounds, right, or hydrophilic compounds. They have to have some kind of charge because the water molecule has polarity to it. All right, what are some important solutes in your body that dissolve in water? Amino acids, easy to do. Sugar molecules, right? Anything that has a lot of polar covalent bonds will dissolve in water. And then here's a really tricky question that our understanding is just changing a little bit. What's the minor solvent in your body? Water is the major one, okay? But you're kind of, we talked about the plasma membrane that kind of foreshadows this concept a little bit. In the very center of the membrane, do you have water molecules? In the very center, phospholipid bilayer, in the center is the lipid, are the lipid pails of the phospholipid. So in the very center of the membrane is a lipid region, is a lipid domain, and that acts as a solvent for all kinds of lipid molecules, right? And so we're going to be interested in that area as well. So the minor solvent in your body is that phospholipid bilayer, the inside of a membrane. And even the inside of the membrane has a lot of activity because it's a special little tiny region that is hydrophobic. All right, so what can you dissolve in this minor solvent? Anything that's hydrophobic, like cholesterol molecules, okay? And give an example. Cholesterol would be a good example, okay? All right, so let's talk about some passive transport processes. The first one is diffusion. All right, so diffusion means that it's a passive process, which means what? Things can go from high concentration to low without energy, right? You don't have to think of any kind of barrier. So if I have a perfume bottle right here and I open it up, the perfume evaporates into the air, and even though there's no fan blowing it around in the room, it's going to move according to its concentration gradient. So first people in the first row will smell it, then the second row. And then if we were to sit here all night long, eventually all the way in the back of the room, people would smell it, and there would be a uniform concentration of perfume. And when there's a uniform concentration of perfume, what's going to happen to the motion of that perfume? It's going to stop. All right, so no perfume is going to move around in the room anymore. So in order for diffusion to take place, there has to be a concentration gradient. So here we have, some kind of container that's got a high concentration of salt on one side and low on the other. And even if we don't mix it up, it's going to mix itself up until there are equal concentrations. And then the motion or the diffusion is going to stop when the concentration is the same. All right, so that is diffusion. That just means that the amount of molecules moving to the left will equal the amount moving to the right, and they'll cancel each other out. They're still going to be moving around, but no net motion. Diffusion is used because it's just a law of our universe. It's used to move materials around in our body. All right, so nonpolar compounds, we said, readily diffuse through the cell membrane because it can get through that lipid region within inside the cell. But also some small molecules can diffuse through some cells, like CO2. And what do you know about CO2? It's a waste product, right? So we want to excrete it from our body. And even water can move through some cells, right? So both CO2 and oxygen can move by diffusion. So what does a cell need in order to be healthy? It needs oxygen, which we see right here. Okay, now how is oxygen delivered to this cell? It's just by diffusion. Where is the concentration of oxygen high? Is it in the cell right here, or is it in the air around us? Yeah, if it's going to move into cells down a concentration gradient, it's got to be high in the air, low inside our cells, and then it just moves into our cells because of that gradient right there. All right, and the cell uses oxygen and produces CO2. So here's a cell that's undergoing respiration. All right, and that CO2 is then excreted from our body by diffusion. So where is CO2 high? Inside our bodies or the atmosphere? It's high inside our bodies, but it leaves because it's very low concentration in the air. It's almost zero in the air. It's actually fairly hard to measure. All right, and it's fairly high inside our bodies. It's a big concentration gradient, so it just leaves. Right, but we have some organ systems like the blood and lungs to help facilitate that process. But the reason why it works is because it's high in our bodies and low outside. So that's important for diffusion. Other kinds of molecules might be impermeable to this lipid region right here. For instance, if this is a polar compound, right, like an ion, it has a charge on it, it can't get through this nonpolar region right here. But there might be times when the cell wants ions to move across the membrane from extracellular to intracellular or vice versa. All right. So in that particular case, the cell has to build a particular protein that looks like a channel or a hole in the membrane. It inserts it into the membrane. So now a molecule can move from one side to the other. All right. And what side has high concentration of this solute molecule? The extracellular, you can count more particles over here than over here. So when this channel opens up, these ions will move inside the cell just by diffusion, right? And does that require ATP? No, that's just diffusion, right? Just due to that concentration gradient. And your cell can control whether this gate is, or this channel is opened or closed. We're going to look at a bunch of those different kinds of channels. So the rate of diffusion, whether it's across a membrane or just in a space, is directly related to four things, right? The magnitude of the concentration gradient. That means how big is the concentration gradient? And as the gradient goes away, what happens to diffusion? It goes away too. So when we say directly related, if any of these things increase, right, if the temperature increases or the permeability increases, what happens to the rate? It increases if it's directly related. I want to use that term a lot in this class. If it's if two variables are directly related, if one goes up, the other one goes up too, right? If one goes down, what happens to the other one? It goes down too. That's directly related. There is one parameter that is inversely related, and that is molecular weight. That's the size of the molecule. All right, and inversely related means that if the molecular weight increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes the other way, it goes down. Okay, so that's what inversely related means. If one goes up, the other goes down. If one goes down, the other one goes up. That's the inverse relationship. And molecular weight is just the size of the molecule, so you could think of maybe a motorcycle and a big semi-tractor trailer at a stoplight, and the light turns green. Which one is going to move faster through the intersection? The one with a smaller weight, which is the motorcycle, right? Same thing for molecules. The bigger, heavier it is, the slower it's going to be. All right, so next time, we're going to start with osmosis right here, but you should kind of be familiar already with osmosis a little bit. And, you know, I forgot to bring one down for my office today. So I don't have a sign-in sheet for today. Somebody should call me before lecture, remind me.